Welcome to the Hamilton Spectator Newsroom Insider podcast. I'm reporter Joanna Frikatich, and I'll be your host this week. First, we'll discuss the ins and outs of court reporting with investigative reporter Steve Buist, focusing on a bitter fight between firefighters over millions of dollars they've claimed from workplace-related illness. Next, photographer Barry Gray will take us back to the Tragically Hip's farewell tour stop in Hamilton and what it was like to shoot such a meaningful concert in the wake of frontman Gord Downie's death on October 17th. Thanks for listening. Saturday's Spectator will feature a bitter legal battle between firefighters over millions of dollars they've claimed from workplace-related illness. Investigative reporter Steve Buist is here to talk about covering the case. Thanks for being here, Steve.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This is a complicated fight that's pitting firefighters against one another. Can you start by telling us a bit about the key players?
Yeah, so on the one side, we have the Ontario Professional Firefighters Association, which represents about 11,000 firefighters, active firefighters across the province. And on the other side of the dispute are two firefighters, one by the name of Colin Grieve, who's with the Hamilton Fire Department, and a gentleman by the name of Paul Atkinson from Toronto. And so the genesis of the story is that Colin Grieve began to gather some expertise as somebody who fought in the Plastimet fire. He started to advocate for firefighters who suffer from job-related illnesses. So firefighters tend to have a lot of cancer issues as well as heart attacks. And so as he delved into it, he started to develop this expertise in helping some of his colleagues take claims to the Workplace Safety and Insurance Board, WSIB. And so as word spread, he became the sort of go-to person for people trying to navigate the claims process. And so Paul Atkinson was doing a similar type of thing. The OPFFA brought them on board as part of their WSIB committee. And then eventually, somewhere in the early 2000s, those two gentlemen were given a full-time job with the association to represent all forms of firefighters, so active firefighters, retired firefighters, the families of deceased firefighters, and sort of help them work their claims through. And so that became their full-time job. They were paid mileage, expenses, per diems, annual honoraria, and the association covered their shifts that they weren't getting back at the municipality, so they paid for replacement people. And so the problem that started to develop was that the OPFFA was running out of money. It was costing a lot of money to try to work these claims through, and so they provided a little bit of seed money. And then what they decided to do was, if you went to the family of a deceased firefighter and they got a claim settled with WSIB, and some of these claims are hundreds of thousands of dollars, some of them are over $1 million, the OPFFA would ask the families of these deceased firefighters, would you like to make a voluntary donation back to us so that we could continue to fight these cases for other firefighters? And so they drew up a letter of agreement, and they first started by asking for 1.5% of the settlement. Mm-hmm. Totally voluntary, you didn't have to do it. Then they discovered that wasn't bringing in enough money, so they raised it, the ask, to three percent, and then 5%. And then eventually they started charging their active firefighter members $1 per month to try to keep the coffers filled. And so things went on that way. And at some point, the association started to have some concerns about the money and this settlement money, because they allege that when they looked at their books, there wasn't nearly enough money coming back from these voluntary donations that they would have expected. And so the OPFFA launched a civil lawsuit against Mr. Grieve and Mr. Atkinson, alleging that they had been misappropriating money from these settlements, and instead they had been allegedly diverting the money into a company that they had created that had an acronym that was very much like the OPFFA. They called theirs Professional Firefighters Advocate Inc., and sometimes they refer to it as PFFA.
Mm-hmm. So just drop the O.
They dropped the O, and so the association alleges that this was part of an actual, in their words, scheme to try to divert money to themselves that should have been going to the association. And it's not chump change. The association alleges that there's at least $3 million in question that they allege was misdirected. And so it's led to this very ugly legal battle between the two sides. If you go to the basement of the Toronto University Avenue Courthouse, you'll find three banker's boxes filled with thousands of pages of documents. And as the legal battle goes on, the fight gets more and more acrimonious. And so there's a $4 million lawsuit launched by the association against Grieve and Atkinson. Grieve and Atkinson have turned around and they're countersuing the association for $12 million. In the interim, Halton police have laid 8 criminal charges against Grieve and Atkinson, alleging that they engaged in fraud, money laundering, and obstruction of justice. So it gets more and more complicated, more and more serious, and more bitter.
Mm-hmm. And so when you, as you said, there's three banker's boxes at the Toronto courthouse. So when you start out with a story like this, and you kind of come across these, you know, you go to look at these banker's boxes, where do you start?
I start first by shedding a few tears.
Yes.
Particularly because these documents were all spiral bound, so it's almost mm-hmm. impossible to get actual pages out.
Mm-hmm.
If it was like a 20-page court document that was stapled together, you'd just pay the 50 cents per page or 20 cents per page or whatever the cost is by the Ontario government, and you'd just photocopy it. Mm-hmm. But when you look at three banker's boxes and literally thousands of pages of documents, you really don't have any choice but to just pull out your notebook, find a comfortable chair in the viewing room, and just start. Just start with box one, document mm-hmm. one, and it's tedious. And, you know, for somebody who would be doing this for the first time, it would probably seem pretty overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over many years of being a spectator reporter, I've done this a lot. And so you sort of start to know which documents are more or less important than others. But really the trick is, you know, you have to be able to read these documents and figure out, okay, what are the important parts of these documents? Otherwise, if you tried to write everything down, you'd be overwhelmed. It would take you weeks to try to, you know, go through page by page writing every paragraph down.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so it's a little bit of an acquired skill in sort of learning what's, you know, what's important, you know, sort of separating the wheat from the chaff. And of course, being fair. So you always have to look at both sides and the arguments that both sides put forward. The reason that while it's very tedious and while it's very, you know, mind-numbing and your eyeballs start to bleed, the reason that journalists like to be able to use these kinds of documents is for our own protection legally. So, you know, we always have to be mindful of the fact that we could be sued for libel or slandering somebody. And so the beauty of the way the system works is that court documents come with certain privileges attached to them so that you can report on things that are in court documents. Again, as long as you're fair and balanced and that you use words like alleged or claim so that mm-hmm. you're not stating it as a fact. Mm-hmm. But it provides journalists with a lot of protection. So mm-hmm. The pain is having to read all those documents. The payoff is that at the end of the day, you know that you're on good legal footing.
And how long do you think it took you to go through all those bankers'
boxes? Yeah, that took me a whole day. Yeah, that one took me a whole day.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And when you're writing about court cases, what are some of the pitfalls that, or some of the challenges that face reporters when, you know, when you're having to write from court documents?
I guess, again, you're protected when you report on statements that are in a statement of claim or a statement of defense that are filed in court. So you have that protection. You know, people can make some pretty outrageous claims in court documents. And, you know, yes, you are protected. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's still fair to use everything that you find in a court document. Plus, you also have to do your best to try to still be fair. You know, so you, for instance, let's, instead of court documents, let's say you're actually covering a court case. So let's say a day was spent, the morning was spent by the prosecution and the afternoon was spent by the defense. And if you wrote a story that was 1,000 words long and 800 of the words had to do with all of the things the prosecution did in the morning, and only a small sliver of your story had to do with the defense in the afternoon, that might be technically admissible, but it's not necessarily fair. So you still have to try to balance, you know, to make sure that, you know, your story does reflect what really is going on in a case.
And how difficult is it to get people to talk to you when a case is before the courts?
Well, it's funny because I'm sure people read lots of stories that include, you know, the standard phrase, you know, so-and-so declined to comment because the matter is still before the court. That's actually, that's a device. It's not a legal requirement. Anyone can talk about anything outside of the court. Just because the matter is before the court doesn't mean that somebody isn't allowed to comment on it. I mean, unless it's covered by a publication ban. But I think what happens, though, is you see that phrase because what it really means is we don't want to talk about it because we don't want to say anything outside of the court that could somehow end up being used against us. But it doesn't mean that you can't talk about it outside of a courtroom. You certainly can. However, if you are going to talk about it, if you're a journalist and you are going to talk to somebody about the case outside of the courtroom, then you have to be mindful that those protections that you have from those documents that are filed in court now no longer apply. So if somebody says something very scandalous to you while you're standing outside on the courtroom, on the sidewalk outside the courthouse, and you write that down, you have no protection for that. So that's why sometimes it's best to just stick to what's safe and what you know you can report.
And the case is going back to court on October 26th and 27th. What can we expect on those days? Like, what is happening on those days?
So this is sort of part of the acrimony that has built up in this case. There have been some, I guess, somewhat unusual steps that have been attempted by primarily the defense in this case. So the gentleman, Grieve and Atkinson, they have been taking some very strong steps against the OPFFA and particularly the lawyers who are representing the association. So Mr. Grieve and Mr. Atkinson went so far as to take the highly unusual step of trying to force the lawyers for the association to get on the witness stand and actually provide evidence against their client, which is almost unheard of. And courts are very, very reluctant to force a lawyer to have to provide evidence against a client because of what's called the solicitor-client privilege, the fact that you should be able to have free discussions with your lawyer. But they actually went that far to try to get them on the stand because they believe that the lawyers for the association have been instrumental in getting the criminal charges laid. So they allege that the lawyers for the association have been in close and unusually close contact with the Halton police and providing them with evidence that the police then turned around and used to lay the criminal charges. So so that's highly unusual. They've also taken the somewhat inflammatory step of actually stating in court documents that they intend to go after the lawyers for the Firefighters Association for malicious prosecution if the criminal charges are either dismissed or never go to trial. So they're basically waving a red flag in front of the bull saying, if my clients, you know, if our clients aren't convicted on the criminal charges, we're going to go after the lawyers for the association. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, that's pretty inflammatory as well. So on the 26th and 27th, there are five motions going forward, which shows you just motions are sort of attempts by one side or the other to sort of change the playing field a little bit. And so the two most important ones are that the Mr. Grieve and Mr. Atkinson are either trying to have the case thrown out entirely, the civil case, or at the very least have it stayed or put aside until the criminal charges are dealt with, because they contend that having to fight two battles at the same time is a bit unfair.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about why it is important for us to, you know, keep an eye on this case and the importance of the ultimate outcome of this case?
Well, I mean, you know, certainly, you know, without wanting to sound too, you know, mom and apple pie about this, you know, our society is built on certain things of certain principles of openness. And one of the things that we believe strongly as a society is that courts should be open. Mm-hmm. And so by that, we also mean that, you know, we should be able and we should be fulfilling the job of making sure that people understand and know about what's going on in our court system. So we, you know, we as journalists, you know, some of the roles that we play are to obviously gather knowledge and disseminate knowledge, but we're also there to be the eyes and ears of the public. And so, you know, if there's 500,000 people in Hamilton, 500,000 people aren't going to go and show up in a courtroom to watch mm-hmm. a case. So it's our job to make sure that we are the eyes and ears of the public. And, you know, cases like this, you know, it's more than just sort of the titillation factor of seeing two sides fighting, you know, a nasty battle. You know, there's some, you know, first of all, there's a fair bit of money allegedly at stake. And, you know, there's the central issue of, you know, firefighters doing a dangerous job and doing it such that they may have certain illnesses and cancers associated with it. And, you know, it's not so much a question that these people are out money themselves or their families are out money, but it's about, you know, who's sort of helping look out for them. Mm-hmm. And is all of that being done properly? Mm-hmm. So you know, it's just another example of us being able to be the eyes and ears of the public.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
The Tragically Hip was the Canadian band when I was growing up. Their music is a big part of the soundtrack of my life, and like so many Canadians, I felt a real sense of loss when frontman Gord Downie died Tuesday at the age of 53. Spectator photographer Barry Gray shot the band's farewell tour stop in Hamilton in August 2016 and is here to talk about the experience. Thanks for being here, Barry.
Oh, you're welcome.
So as a spec photographer, you must shoot a lot of concerts. What was that atmosphere? Do you remember what the atmosphere was like that night compared to, you know, other concerts?
Oh, it was definitely different. I mean, everybody's always excited to go to a concert anyway, but the circumstances around Gord and his diagnosis and the final tour and all that, everybody was very emotional. The people gathering out front, there was a lot of emotion. I mean, these were the diehard fans for sure, but there was something extra. It was palpable. You could feel it. You know, it was just a lot of people just realized this was going to be it mm-hmm. to see the Hip.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that you sort of wanted to capture that night? You know, when you went in there and saw that, what was your goal?
You know, the first thing that people have to understand when you shoot a concert and people say, oh, wow, you get to go to all these concerts, that's great. They don't understand that when you go to a concert, you get three songs maximum. You can get less. You never get more. You know, there's a handful of bands. The Grateful Dead is the classic band that let you stay. If you wanted to stay all night, you could mm-hmm. stay all night. Most bands, it's three songs maximum. It's typically the first three songs, it might be songs two and three, it might be one and two, whatever, right? So you get a very short little window. They collect all the photographers, they march you in, they'll tell you backstage, mm-hmm. you're either going to be front of stage or you're mm-hmm. going to be back by the soundboard, which makes a big difference in what lenses you're using, whether mm-hmm. you're, you know, 20 or 30 feet away or 300 feet away, mm-hmm. right? So, and you go in and it's a bit of a, it's a rush. It's, and I don't mean a physical rush. It's a rushy thing to get done because you yes. know you only have so long, right? Yeah. And depending on the lighting and depending on the singer and what he or she does, you just kind of never know what you're going to get. You're always hoping that you can capture the energy of the performer. And with Gord, I mean, it's easy. Gord mm-hmm. is, he's a showman. He plays to the crowd. And I think veteran performers like that, they have a sense of, they know, I think, we're there mm-hmm. for a short period of time, and mm-hmm. they'll be very good. You'll see them sometimes. The photographers will split up in the front row, and they'll walk over to one group at one side, say, and then maybe Gord will come back to the other side. And you can just get a sense that, I know you're here, and I'm going to let you guys get what you need and get something good. So, mm-hmm. but you play it by ear. It's the quintessential play it by ear.
Yeah. And what's the biggest challenge when you're covering a concert? What's the biggest challenge to getting a good shot?
Probably the lighting. Mm-hmm. Because there are bands now that will come out and they'll say, okay, well, the photographer can be here for the first two songs. And the first two songs, they've decided that the singer and the band look really good, you know, backlit with blue light. Mm-hmm. And there's no actual light on them, which if you're just a fan sitting in your seat, probably looks really cool. But as a photographer, it's just a nightmare. And you just, and there's nothing you can do about it, because most of the bands, again, will tell you up front, no flash, right? Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the one stipulation, no mm-hmm. flash. You will live by the light we provide.
And what's the sort of the key to getting that good photograph? What do you find, you know, is the key to getting the
you know what, you're just watching them and their reactions and stuff, and it can be, it's hard too, because a band will come in on a tour, and unless you had some prior knowledge, you don't necessarily know what's going to happen. You know, they'll I wish I had known at that point so-and-so was going to run over to the guitarist and they're going to do something, or he's going to run around and play the drummer's mm-hmm. drums or something, right? And mm-hmm. you may know, but you may not know either. Mm-hmm. So you follow them through the lens and you just literally just shoot your brains out. Mm-hmm. You just take hundreds of pictures and just hope for the best.
Mm-hmm. And now at concerts, everybody has their cell phone out and is trying to get a picture at the concert with their cell phone. Is it possible to get a good concert picture with your cell phone, and how do you do that?
It's possible if you're in the front row.
Okay.
I mean,
yes.
you've got to be close, right? I mean, they have mm-hmm. a limited amount of zoom. If you're in the front row, I mean, mm-hmm. if I'm in the front row mm-hmm. and in the front of the stage and you're in the front row, you're mm-hmm. literally right behind me. Mm-hmm. So if you have your phone up and mm-hmm. that singer comes right to the edge of the stage, you could get a pretty good shot. Mm-hmm. It's not impossible. If you're farther back, you're going to have an atmospheric shot. You're going to have a sea of dark heads and some light off in the distance, and mm-hmm. you'll show your friends and say, you see that dot? That was Gord Downie. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's the reality. But everybody will shoot it anyway because mm-hmm. you're right there, right? Which is the other funny part now, is that a lot of bands are increasingly placing restrictions on media for what we can shoot and what our rights of publication are, and, you know, rights after the fact and rights in terms of social media. And meanwhile, there's 18,000 people behind you that are all holding their phone up, taking a picture, and then immediately tweeting it or putting it on Facebook or whatever.
And a picture that's not nearly the same quality.
Yeah, yeah. But it's still, it's just out there, right? Mm-hmm. And they'll do it again all night long, whereas we'll get three songs. And typically why that is, they'll get you in, get you out, and then they'll do their cool stuff in the middle of the show if we've got some pyrotechnics or some aerial thing, right? But we don't really want you to get that. You know, if people hear about that and they want to come to our show and buy tickets, so much the better. But we don't really need you getting a picture of that. But meanwhile, you can be in row 18 and, you know, just clicking away, just shooting away on your phone.
Do you remember, did the Tragically Hip used to have any strange requests, or were they easier or difficult to work with than most bands? Do you have any memory of that?
I mean, they've been in Hamilton a few times. That was the only time I've photographed them. I don't remember. It seems to me there was something odd, but I don't remember what it was. We were okay. You know, we typically file our request for accreditation, you know, through the local arena promoter, and they'll get back to us and say yes or no, you can go. And then again, you show up beforehand and they will lay down the law of the land. You get this many songs and they'll hold your hand and guide you in and guide you out and make sure you leave, make sure you didn't just wander off somewhere and continue shooting. And that's how it goes.
And do you remember when it comes to bands, either the craziest thing you've come across or the most difficult, like, is there something that stands out for you in your years of shooting concerts?
There's been some bizarre stuff. I mean, I remember shooting Marilyn Manson once at, you know, formerly Cops, and I remember being right up in the front, which kind of became more of a mosh pit, and his hair was soaking wet, and he was flicking his hair forward, and the water was flying off his hair down onto me and everybody else, which I thought was a little gross, but...
And possibly on your lenses, too.
Yeah. And of course the other thing is that if you're front and center, depending who it is, you know, if it's Motley Crue or something like that, it's also ridiculously loud. So experience will teach you to bring a pair of earplugs, because you sometimes can be stationed literally right in front of a speaker that's taller than you are, and you'll be very sad if you didn't bring earplugs.
And what has been your best experience with shooting a concert? You know, is there a band that really sticks out for you, or a certain occasion that really sticks out for you?
That's tough. I enjoyed shooting this concert a lot because I knew what this meant. You knew what this was, and, you know, I'm a fan of the Hip, so that was a bonus. You know, any of the bands that are iconic, Rush was here, photographed them. There's been a lot over the years, but... Yeah, I guess it depends too. Yeah, if you're a fan, you'd be more interested in wanting to do it. I mean, when Motley Crue played here, and they've played here several times, one of the first times when they came back here, I wanted to photograph it just because I had said, these guys should probably all be dead, right? From their partying and everything else. They're like the Stones. The fact that they're still up there playing is like the most ridiculous thing ever. So I want to photograph these guys. And I mean, they still do the whole show. They've got the women crawling around on the stage, and it's theatrical and it's overdone, and they're all, you know, 70 years old and they're still going. Yes. And it's just ridiculous. And it's just fun to be there and see that.
Yeah. And do you have a favorite shot from the night that you did the Tragically Hip concert? Is there a shot that stands out for you?
I had a picture of Gord with a light behind him shining down, and he's very much kind of silhouetted. It was very much the light, and then I had converted it to a black and white shot, and it just, I don't know, it was just something about the light and the angle, but, you know, everything I had, it was all, I could look at them, and they were all so quintessentially Gord Downie, right? And it's just because you see those pictures over and over, right? You see them in the papers, and you see, I mean, again, he was such a showman, that it was just a lot of fun, and it's just sad to think that, you know, we don't get to see that anymore.
And you've been posting a lot of your photos from that night on, you know, various social media and spec forums and things, spec platforms. What kind of reaction have you been getting to your shots?
you know, a lot of people really enjoyed seeing them again. It's been a very emotional week for Canada, mm-hmm. for us, for his fans and stuff. So I think a lot of those people that saw them just really enjoyed seeing them again, because that was, what, a year and 2 months, yeah, yeah. roughly, you know. So, and I had posted them back then. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'll put these out here again and just let people enjoy them. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely enjoyed them. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for being here today.
Yeah, no problem.